Good morning. I think this whole question of solutions strikes me as a little bit overstated. I don't think we're near solutions yet. Solutions imply that you actually solve the problem. I think we're a long way from solving the problem. I think what we are coming up with is a lot of creative strategies, a lot of interesting approaches, a lot of bright ideas, some of which may turn out to work and others which may not. So today we're going to talk about them, and what I'm going to do before I turn it over to the panelists to talk about some of the bright ideas, strategies, approaches, and such, is provide a short background to try to provide a bit of a market context for the strategies, approaches, bright ideas. Before I do, just very briefly, we have here three people who know a lot about what's going on around the country. You can read their bios in detail in the program book. We have Harold Simon, who's the executive director and publisher of National Housing Institute and Shelter Force magazine. Judy Jacobson, who's the deputy director and general counsel of the Massachusetts Housing Partnership. And finally, Sarah Greenberg, whom I suspect most of you know. She's been a very constant presence in the foreclosure prevention and community stabilization world, who is the, I believe, senior manager for community stabilization at NeighborWorks America. So first, let me talk for a few minutes about what's going on and what its implications are for community stabilization. First, basic information. The housing market has been slipping. Prices are flat. We have no idea at this point. Looking at the most recent data that's come out in the last couple of weeks, it's very bad. As an awful lot of people predicted, the home buyer tax credit accelerated home buying for people who almost certainly would have bought the houses sooner or later, meaning that once it expired, demand for housing, roughly speaking, fell off a cliff. At this point, we have a roughly 13-month supply of existing housing in the inventory, and demand seems to be dropping rather than rising to meet supply. One thing that I think is very significant is in the last 4 years, we've seen an incredible change in the composition of the population in terms of tenure. We now have 3 million more renters than we had in 2006, and we've seen a decline in the number of homeowners. We're back in terms of homeownership rate. We're roughly speaking back to 1999, and again, given the trends, this is likely to drop further before it stabilizes. Mortgage delinquencies, even though, according to the Mortgage Bankers National Delinquency Survey, there was a small drop-off in the last quarter, they're still at rates that are extraordinarily elevated. And what this means for the REO inventory and the supply of properties, though, is complicated. This is a graph that you can see this in my article in the book, is tried to show how the extent to which properties get diverted from REO outcomes in the course of the foreclosure process. And this has really increased in the last year and a half or 2 years. And in fact, people have commented on the effect of moratoria, the effect of different forbearance programs, loan modification programs, short sales, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, including greater buying of properties by investors at foreclosure sales. The outcome has been that what we're seeing, and this is, I think, the real meaning of the shadow inventory, not a conspiracy, so much as a series of different factors have accumulated, including servicer behavior and others, to result in a growing number of properties sort of stuck in what you might think of as that image of the pig in the python's throat, is that they are stuck somewheres in the foreclosure process. They may come out of it, they may not come out of it, but gradually the number of properties that are in the process compared to the number of properties that are coming out of the other end of the process is steadily getting greater and greater. Now, just here, I thought a couple of interesting statistics. There were really a huge number of home retention actions through HAMP and the other programs have been initiated. Each one of these represents, at a minimum, a delay in a process coming out of the other end. However, most of them only represent a delay rather than a permanent diversion from the process. Short sales have been increasing, and in some markets, particularly the Sun Belt markets, short sales have really been taking off. And meanwhile, the number of new foreclosure starts continues to go up. And so what's happening is all of the numbers are going up. The number of foreclosures completed, the number of starts, the numbers in the process, the number of defaults. But as you can see, some are going up faster than others, and the inventory is simply accumulating. So what does this mean? When you look at we have a huge set of broad environmental problems in terms of housing and economic growth. Though, as I think a lot of people have pointed out, there are huge regional variations in terms of the housing market and housing conditions. Not only are these gross regional variations from the Midwest to New England to the Southwest and so forth, but even, for example, in California, there's been a significant divergence in the last year and a half, in terms of price and market activity from the coastal counties, which have shown some recovery, to the inland counties, which are still tailing off. So at the neighborhood scale, this has some very powerful implications, I think, for the kind of strategies that we think about. There's a continued flow of properties into default and a continued flow of REO properties. But we're seeing the period, and this is true whether you're talking about a state like New Jersey with a fairly consumer-oriented judicial foreclosure system or a state like Arizona with a non-judicial foreclosure system. The period from default to some ultimate resolution is getting longer and longer and longer and longer. And what that means is that properties in our neighborhoods are in some form of limbo for a longer and longer period. Meanwhile, home buyer demand remains weak, and I think an important point, which I think has been mentioned, but I think needs a lot more emphasis, is not only that investors are actively competing for distressed property, whether it's foreclosures, bidding at foreclosure sales, creating induced short sales, and the like, but that this pool of investor property that is being created and is growing within America's communities represents an enormous challenge, as well as to some extent an opportunity for policymakers to address. It's certainly not going to go away, and it's certainly not going to take care of itself, so it has to be addressed. Now, this, of course, all has tremendous implications on what's happening in the neighborhoods themselves. And so properties are increasingly at risk of abandonment. People who live in the neighborhoods where they are confronted by the presence of vacant and foreclosed properties are themselves investing less and less. As a number of people mentioned yesterday, it's becoming very difficult in many markets to find buyers for rehabilitated properties, which creates a whole set of other issues. And, of course, because of the investor purchases, that raises a whole series of other issues. So I think what this says, and I think this goes back to President Rosengren's comment just a few minutes ago, is we really have to think, very broadly and very comprehensively about these issues. We can't simply think that if we're going to take and fix up or demolish a handful of properties in a neighborhood, that in itself can take care of the problem. We have to think about what's happening as a process of destabilization of entire communities, of entire neighborhoods, and how we can come up with comprehensive ways of addressing those communities. And I would suggest in the final analysis, what we need to be doing, that is rebuild confidence. What has happened to the housing market is, as much as anything, a crisis of consumer confidence, and in our neighborhoods, in our homes, in the idea of home ownership. We have to rebuild confidence, rebuild market demand, if we are going to stabilize the neighborhoods. And Lord knows that is a difficult task at this point. But, and again, this is where I segue into the presentations. There are, and this is, I guess, the positive part of it. Despite all of this, the number of ideas, approaches, strategies that are emerging locally around the country to try to address these issues is not only impressive, but actually awe-inspiring. However, we shall see ultimately what outcomes they have. But we're in a point and sort of in process now. And I think what we're going to be talking about today are ideas that are emerging, some of the lessons that have started to be learned from those ideas, and what the possibilities they may offer for the future. So thank you, and I'd like to turn to Harold to begin.
Well, thank you, Alan, and good morning to everyone, and thank you all for giving me the opportunity to talk today. I'm going to be talking about the Community Asset Preservation Corporation, but I'm not going to go into too much detail. You'll find an article on it on page 123 of the REO publication that was handed out, and there's also some information in the brochure that was given out. So what I'm going to do is provide kind of an overview and history of the organization, what it's accomplished so far, and then talk about the challenges and the lessons to the field that we've learned from the project. So the Community Asset Preservation Corporation, or CAPC, was conceived in late 2007-2008 by a group of housing professionals, including myself and Alan, who actually named the organization, as an attempt to deal with the coming REO crisis, because it was very clear that this was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger as we went along. And the idea of CAPC was very simple. We would just buy a whole bunch, a pool or a portfolio of REO and mortgages and or mortgages, and then as quickly as possible put them back into productive reuse in an equitable way. That didn't seem all that hard then. One of our partners, Housing and Neighborhood Development Services of Orange, a noted CDC in the state, did a tremendous job of reducing the number of abandoned vacant properties in their community from 400 to about 40 over a 10-year period. But they noticed in 2007, not surprisingly, that began to tick up. So they poked around and discovered that a couple of these abandoned properties were not in foreclosure, but they weren't going anywhere. They were in limbo. And so by doing a little more exploration, they found that this was part of a pool of about 47 mortgages that were held by a portfolio lender. And after some discussion, it became very clear that this could be our proof of concept project. So with Hans and the nascent CAPC, we approached the lender and said, you know, we'd like to buy all these mortgages. And so after they stopped laughing because they had no idea who we were or what we were even, the negotiation became serious, and they gave us a due diligence period where we could go in and actually take a look at all these properties and see what we could offer. So we went in, and we examined each of the properties and figured out what it would cost to rehab them if it was rehabable. We also figured out exactly what we might be able to sell them for, and we developed three scenarios: a best case, a worst case, and a likely case. Now, in New Jersey, unlike Detroit or Cleveland, there were transactions going on, so there was a market. But in New Jersey, as Alan pointed out, it was also judicial foreclosure state, so we knew we had about 2 years of going through the foreclosure process on these mortgages. Now, these were all absentee owner buildings. They're all speculators. The buildings were all abandoned and vacant for the most part. All of them deteriorated, all of them harming their neighbors and their neighborhoods. They were also not in one place. They were scattered around the state, with the majority of them being in the greater Newark area. So while we were trying to figure out how much we could afford to pay to do the deal, because this was very much a demand-side valuation model, we would know what we could pay and not a penny more, otherwise we just couldn't do it. To do strategic neighborhood development, we couldn't be doing a house here and a house here and a house there, and the single organization just couldn't be developing all of these. So we developed, put together a CDC collaborative of CDCs in the greater Newark area, and then reached out to other organizations, for-profit and nonprofit, around the state. We also had to get some money to do this. So we put together a group of potential funders, all of them who were experienced in community development, and knew that this was really an important project, but they sort of had a hard time wrapping their minds around exactly what we were doing. And these included Prudential Social Investments, NeighborWorks, LISC, Enterprise. What ended up happening was that New Jersey Community Capital developed a wonderful 80-20 debt-to-equity package, and that high first loss ratio really gave comfort to the lenders, and so we put together a $3.5 million deal. So that's how we started. We knew we had two difficult years ahead of us. A year later, all but six of the 47 mortgages have clear title. Only two are in foreclosure, and four have some title problems. Most of this is through deed in lieu. CAPSI is now a subsidiary of New Jersey Community Capital. It's a statewide CDFI, the largest one in New Jersey, and now has a statewide footprint. It's a designated community coordinator for New Jersey by the National Community Stabilization Trust for its First Look REO acquisition program, so a lot of words. It is also in the process of, in the process of developing some financing tools, a state-supported revolving acquisition fund, a new market tax credit program, a $15 million revolving loan pool, and this is done in collaboration with the grantees of the Newark Area NSP2 program, who agreed to contribute some of their award as a first loss reserve to leverage up additional funding. They've also secured a $3 million financing commitment from NCST's REO Capital Fund and a $1 million financing commitment from the Community Housing Capital and NeighborWorks America CDFI, all to get a quick acquisition fund. Since that 47, CAPSI has purchased another 16 properties from Chase, a small group from one of the GSEs, is negotiating for a pool of 75 of both REO and mortgages, and has also started discussions on 150 apartment units in 5 to 9 unit buildings. And this is on the commercial side to buy the notes for these buildings and preserve affordable rental assistance. And it's also providing technical assistance to nonprofits and municipalities and joint ventures with Youth Build and other organizations. It's important to point out that when we thought of this, this was before NSP. We thought that what the opportunity here, tragic as it might be, the opportunity here was to create an infrastructure, something that would last beyond this crisis, that would more efficiently do community development. So I want to discuss just very quickly some lessons and challenges that this has taught us. So for various reasons, internal and external, the community development world was relatively unprepared for the scope and speed of this crisis. And so we think we need to rethink, in part, how development takes place. After all, neighborhood stabilization really is, as has been pointed out before, community development. So we have a number of ideas, and they're really questions, because we have been limited in going to scale by these same things. And so we put them under two kind of broad categories. There are more in the book. But the first is, you know, money really talks. And as investors are moving into the space that we're in, they have a whole lot of money that's flexible, and they can transact pretty quickly. faster than most nonprofits, if not all of them. So even at a smaller scale, CAPSE and other organizations really need ready and flexible financing. So how do we provide that? And so these are the questions. Can we redeploy community government subsidy dollars to guarantee debt, leverage up that money? Can we increase the scale of mission-related or impact investments? Can we overcome our reliance on subsidy and really leverage those dollars? Can we move away from project-based underwriting and go to enterprise-level underwriting financing? And most importantly, how do we access capital markets, either on our own or with private sector partners? The other broad category is mindset helps or hinders. We've developed a great infrastructure of community development and affordable housing finance in this country. But it really has not been as effective as it could be in this environment. So as a CDC field, how do we rethink what we do to go outside of our neighborhood paradigm? Can states and municipalities use subsidy to encourage that kind of thinking, incentivize collaborations, to pool capacities, resources, and encourage strategic and comprehensive approaches to community development? Can we develop market-rate homes to internally cross-subsidize our work without compromising our missions? We did this at CAPSE, so some of them were affordable housing, some of them were knocked down because they were really bad, and some of them were sold at market rate to either homeowners or responsible investors. And finally, can the nonprofit development organizations begin to compete with or partner with for-profits? So many times, nonprofits have been the training ground for staff that then go on to work in the for-profit industry. So we've done a lot. There are a lot of things that are keeping us from growing, and hopefully we'll have a dialogue here that can lead to some answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Harold. I just mentioned a statistic that I came up with when I was doing some research in Phoenix and looking at how on the theme that money talks, that in the second half of 2009, the amount invested by absentee investors in buying properties in the Phoenix metro area was conservatively between $1.5 and $1.8 billion. So, I mean, that's this issue of money. When you think about NSP, you think about the limited resources available on the community side, this question of how you access capital if you really want to be able to do any of this stuff at scale, I think is a huge issue. So turning now to Judy in Massachusetts.
Thanks, Alan. I'm very proud about the way Massachusetts housing and community development community came together around the issue of foreclosed properties and their impact on neighborhoods. Alan asked that we focus on lessons learned, so I want to talk a little first about the process we used in Massachusetts for developing an approach to the problem, and then about the ups and downs of some of the strategies we've been pursuing. It was early 2008 when a couple of local groups convened a meeting focused on addressing the neighborhood impacts of foreclosures. Out of that, we formed a statewide foreclosed properties task force. Somehow, lucky me, I became one of the co-chairs of the task force. We established a few basic principles for the task force. First, we wanted to use a bottom-up approach. There were already local nonprofits and municipalities focused on the problem, so we wanted to support them and share information so local initiatives could be successful and potentially be replicated. Second, we wanted to work on multiple issues simultaneously, so we decided to do our work through a subcommittee structure. It's not enough to have money to renovate a property if you can't acquire it. We knew that in 2008, and it has certainly proven to be true over time. So we had people focused on acquisition, on financing, on holding strategies, and on exit strategies. Third, because we have so many wonderful housing organizations in Massachusetts, we didn't want to create another one that required care and feeding. So we decided that the task force would be time limited, and we established a 6-month time frame for it. We were very optimistic. We did think it important that the task force be everyone's and not anyone's. So we created a very amorphous group. We sought broad cross-sector participation, and we had an open door policy for meetings. It was a little crazy. I can remember people sitting on windowsills in my office at meetings. It's a good thing Prabal and Kai are small. But it worked. There was broad ownership. Many things came out of our task force. I'm going to talk about the Neighborhood Stabilization Loan Fund and other initiatives in a minute. And although the task force, which wound down by late 2008, early 2009, seems like ancient history, there are some good lessons learned. The approach we used, featuring local groups and municipalities who had ideas about how they wanted to attack the problem, and then seeking input from others, what we dubbed our test community approach, served us very well. Out of this, for instance, came the receivership initiative, a direct response to the city of Worcester's efforts. Worcester, a weak market city with limited local nonprofit capacity, realized early on that they had to find a way to get at the problem properties in a broad way. More on that in a moment. And although I was one of the people who felt strongly that the task force should do its work and then go away, and we did arrange for different initiatives to be housed within existing organizations post-task force, I think we really lost something by not having some infrastructure to keep us coordinated and communicating as a state. We all retreated to our corners to implement our programs. We had to. You can't just talk. But when I look at what our friends in Minnesota, for example, put together, I'm completely blown away. Their Foreclosure Partners Council is amazing and should be looked at as a model. My takeaway is that when you have a multifaceted problem for which there is no silver bullet, you need infrastructure to organize all the different players, and that does take care and feeding. Finding ways to support that is very important. If anybody is interested in learning more about the Massachusetts Task Force experience, Citizens Housing and Planning Association, CHAPA, did a report that's available on their website. It's chapa.org. Or get in touch with me, and I'll get you a copy. I want to spend a few minutes talking about some of the programs we've been operating in Massachusetts. I'll focus on the ones my organization, the Massachusetts Housing Partnership, or MHP, is involved in. You'll hear more about the Boston programs from my colleagues on the next panel. So first, just a minute on MHP. We are a nonprofit, quasi-public. Most of our funding comes from the banking industry. We are a lender. We provide long-term financing for apartment buildings. And we created and operate a very successful first-time homebuyer program, which has helped almost 15,000 low- and moderate-income families buy their first home. Given that we are a multifamily lender, it was logical for us to support a financing vehicle for responsible developers of foreclosed properties. The Neighborhood Stabilization Loan Fund, which I've described in a handout that's in your folders, it's got the MHP logo on the right-hand corner, has really started to get some traction in the last few months. We've got about 30 developers who have been given what I call hunting licenses to find properties in target areas in 14 cities. Most of these properties are three-deckers, so this is very retail. We found that our high-capacity nonprofits, small for-profits, and nonprofits who are teamed up with for-profits are the most successful. You have to be nimble and quick. This is way different than developing a tax credit project. We are underwriting all of the properties for a rental outcome, although some in stronger markets, like Boston, are able to sell to homeowners. But we always make sure that it works as a rental and that there is a permanent takeout. Ours is a buyer-driven model, which grew out of our task force's decentralized focus. As we've gone along, we've learned some things from our friends in places like Chicago and have in recent months been encouraging the use of intermediary acquirers to bring capacity and efficiency in communities where it's needed. And despite our award of substantial NSP funds, our consortium was one of three successful NSP2 applicants in Massachusetts. We know we are only going to touch a relatively few properties. So we've stepped up our efforts to find ways to enhance the positives in our target neighborhoods and to deal with the negatives. We're using our test community approach for this and are looking at some creative funding mechanisms, like increasing developer fees and requiring that the funds be used for neighborhood improvements, and using our NSP2 admin funds to increase municipal capacity to do code enforcement. On the homeownership side, We used NSP 1 funds to enhance MHP's soft second loan program for home buyers of foreclosed properties. We heard a lot yesterday about the lack of reasonable mortgage credit for home buyers in many areas of the country. Not in Massachusetts. Soft second provides a low down payment, fixed rate, no PMI, graduated payment mortgage. It's offered by 43 participating lenders in Massachusetts. Public funds are used for interest subsidies and for loan loss reserves in lieu of PMI. Over the program's almost 20-year history, a $69 million public investment has leveraged over $2.2 billion in private bank financing. And although our delinquency and foreclosure rates are up in recent years, they are still below those of Massachusetts' prime mortgages, not subprime, prime mortgages. So the performance is very good. Soft second is a great model for how to do homeownership right. Although soft second has been a terrific tool for homebuyers purchasing foreclosed properties, and over the last year we had 185 foreclosed properties representing 252 units purchased by soft second buyers. But we found integrating NSP funds into the mix very challenging, and as a result, only a small fraction of those acquisitions were supported by NSP. The regulatory burdens associated with NSP, combined with the challenges of supporting direct home buyer rehab, which somehow always seems to mushroom, has caused us to shift to a streamlined developer-to-homebuyer model. Because we want sale prices to be as close to market as possible, we'll be using NSP as mortgage write-down assistance and requiring recapture upon sale, no resale restrictions. Finally, I want to touch on our receivership initiative. Massachusetts has had a law on our books for a long time, allowing courts to appoint receivers where there are code violations that the property owner is not addressing. Along with our Attorney General's office, we've been promoting the use of receivership. We have a comprehensive receivership handbook on our website at mhp.net. But through our test communities of Worcester and Springfield, we realized that it's not just about knowing how to do it. It's about the ability to do the work, to execute. So we set up and are providing funding to nonprofit administrators to work with the municipalities to identify properties, do the work write-offs, and identify and train receivers. And we've made our Neighborhood Stabilization Loan Fund available to receivers as a source of funding. If I had to point to a theme that runs through our experience in Massachusetts, and the receivership initiative really exemplifies this, I'd say it's about capacity. We all had full-time jobs before the foreclosure crisis, and that work hasn't gone away. TA and training is all good, but what's really needed and what really gets results is support for the infrastructure needed to get the work done. I'll end on that thought. Thanks.
Thank you. Sarah?
Thank you, Ellen, and thank you to the Federal Reserve for inviting me here today. I will mention that the Federal Reserve has been a great partner to NeighborWorks America's foreclosure response efforts. And I have to say, the setup here, I feel like I should either be seated next to my attorney or possibly talking about the big game. For those of you who are not familiar with NeighborWorks America, we are a national nonprofit intermediary created by Congress in the mid-70s to support community-based revitalization efforts. And though I wasn't around at the time, I hear that a lot of the challenges they were dealing with at that time are very similar to what our communities are facing today. I have the privilege in my role of working with our network of more than 235 affiliated nonprofit organizations across the country, about half of which are actively engaged in neighborhood stabilization efforts, most of those funded by the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. So today I'd like to share some promising approaches and early lessons from their efforts. Most of these approaches are not new, but they are showing some early signs of success. And I'll mention that the solutions are very market-specific, but there are a lot of common challenges. And it's been interesting working at the national level to watch the evolution of neighborhood stabilization efforts as organizations in very different markets experience the same challenges. So the first promising approach I want to discuss We have a number of organizations that are purchasing unfinished subdivisions when a builder goes into foreclosure. This is primarily a Sunbelt strategy, as you can imagine. The lots that they're purchasing have already been improved. Some of them actually have finished or unfinished structures on them. These groups are having some successes, and they've learned a few lessons. In Phoenix, they're already beginning to resell some of these units, and what they found is that a very careful choice of location was key. They chose strong neighborhoods in inner-ring suburbs. They were served by transit, and they had decent schools. As an affordable housing strategy, this is exciting because these are brand new units. They're larger units. They have high-end fixtures. They're not typically what you think of when you say affordable housing. We have a group in South Texas that's taking a little different approach. They're using the land bank provision of NSP to hold the land until demand returns and the market can absorb these units. The second promising approach I want to discuss is similar to the first. We have some organizations that are purchasing foreclosed condo units, and this is primarily a West Coast strategy, and it's really been driven by the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. The organizations have a need to purchase a lot of units quickly, turn a lot of units in a short period of time, and the neighborhoods that qualified for Neighborhood Stabilization Program funds, because they had so many condo foreclosures, so in certain neighborhoods on the West Coast, the number of condo foreclosures actually pushed some of these neighborhoods over the edge into qualifying for these funds. So our organizations are taking the opportunity to create and preserve affordability in neighborhoods that were lacking affordable options just a few years ago. And this is helping their mission of creating mixed-income neighborhoods as well. A few early lessons and challenges. We've heard this throughout the conference. Suburban neighborhoods are really a new frontier for many nonprofit organizations. And this strategy in particular may take organizations outside their typical target neighborhoods. And so it requires careful planning and a clear mission. These organizations also may encounter some resistance to affordable housing efforts, even though in many cases it's the municipality that's inviting them in. The third promising approach, I have a little hesitation in mentioning it, but it's lease purchase, and I'll talk about that hesitation. We are seeing some early success in lease purchase programs that are using NSP to reoccupy foreclosed properties. In our network, there seems to be two different approaches. Some organizations view this as a rental strategy, and some view it as a homeownership strategy, and I'll explain that. The organizations that view it as a rental strategy really plan to hold the property for the long term. They use the lease option to attract higher quality tenants, and they try to move them towards homeownership, whether it's that particular unit or possibly a different unit. We have an organization in Waco, Texas, that has already converted four formerly foreclosed units through a lease purchase program using this strategy. We have some other organizations that really view it as a homeownership strategy. And I'll mention one organization in Colorado. They're running what they call a Learn, Earn, Own program. So they call it an LEO program. And they allow the client to choose the property, just like a regular home buyer. They require some sweat equity in the rehab. And this promotes an ownership mindset from the start. And they found some success using this. What the two different strategies have in common is they really do a careful choice of stronger neighborhoods and high-quality properties to make this a sustainable strategy over the long term. Couple of lessons and challenges here. The availability of NSP subsidy is really making these programs possible right now. So these organizations need to have an exit strategy for when that subsidy goes away, or they need to be prepared for long-term ownership of these properties. The long-term success for any scattered site rental really does require significant scale, and research in our network shows that that scale is somewhere around 250 or more units. So turning this from a short-term foreclosure strategy to a long-term strategy is going to require quite a bit of effort. The fourth promising approach I'd like to mention is resident engagement, and this is really a cornerstone of the NeighborWorks network. And I wanted to make sure I mention it because I don't hear it discussed in these settings very often. We have organizations in places as diverse as South Tucson, Northern New Jersey, and Chelsea, Massachusetts, having success in involving residents in both the planning and the implementation of their neighborhood stabilization efforts. This includes planning charrettes to create a vision for the neighborhood, and there are many options for implementation depending on the plan. We've seen residents tending community gardens, leading neighborhood cleanup efforts, block watches, assisting with vacant property surveys. A couple lessons and challenges here is that resident engagement is really a long-term investment as well, and it has to be integrated with your other programs. NeighborWorks America actually considers community building and organizing as a line of business and supports it as such. And our groups have found that residents don't really know how to be engaged, so they really need to be trained and educated in how to do that. There's a very successful model for resident engagement that was actually developed by a NeighborWorks organization called Neighbor Circles, and I would encourage you to look that up if you're interested. So each of these promising approaches has something in common, which is that the local organization is taking on a lot of risk as a result of the foreclosure crisis. In some cases, they are revisiting programs that haven't worked in the past, and they're working in an environment of constantly shifting subsidies and incentives. And that brings me to my last point, which is the role of intermediaries. Both Judy and Harold mentioned intermediaries in their talks. Regional and national intermediaries are critical to support these local efforts. NeighborWorks has invested in all of these efforts through capital and operating support, training and technical assistance, serving as an innovation laboratory, providing early funding to test these new strategies, and then disseminating those best practices and lessons learned. So I just want to close by saying, you know, we have another round of NSP funding on the way, and I think it's critical that we at the national level focus on working together to continue to support these efforts.
Great. Thank you, Sarah, and thank you, panelists. I'd just like, before I open it up to questions and comments, just like to make two comments that were prompted by some of the suggestions and ideas that came out here. One is, and I think we kind of appreciate it, but I don't think we fully appreciate the implications of it, is that getting into this whole neighborhood stabilization thing is a long-term proposition. I mean, at the absolute best, when the NSP 1 money is spent, when the NSP 2 money is spent, these neighborhoods will not be done. This is a long-term process, and groups that are engaged in this process are going to have to figure out how to gear up and maintain their ability to provide the activities they're doing for the long haul. Because, and I think this also relates to some of the points that President Rosengren made before, is that an awful lot of these neighborhoods that people are working in, the neighborhoods that are hard hit by foreclosure, were not all that stable before the foreclosure crisis. In fact, many of them, I think disproportionately, these were areas that had many serious social, economic, physical problems that in some respects were obscured because of the home buying and the property appreciation and so forth that was driven heavily by subprime lending and speculation. So there were a lot of problems that were already there and that are not going to go away even after the foreclosure crisis, God willing, starts to abate. And the third point that I want to make, which goes back to, I think, Sarah's closing point about engagement, is that if you look at a typical neighborhood, any neighborhood, the number or the percentage of properties that are going to be directly involved in stabilization activities is a very small percentage. The number of properties that are in foreclosure or going to be in foreclosure or become REO is a significantly larger percentage, but still a relatively small one compared to the total number of properties in the community. Ultimately, the vitality of that community is going to depend more than anything else on the other 80 or 90 or 95% of the households who are living in this community, seeing what is going on, are engaged or are not engaged, as the case may be, and will ultimately make decisions about whether this is a community they want to live in or invest in. So I think engaging people, thinking about that other 90% and how they're being affected by this crisis, I think is critically important. So this is a lot of food for thought. So questions, comments? Again, you have to identify yourself, I believe.
Sir, thank you. Jim Brooks, National League of Cities. My question goes to two either compatible or potentially incompatible aspects here. I'm mindful yesterday and today of the constant drumbeat of the need to leverage private sector capital. Also, in the bag of tricks that lots of communities and housing intermediaries are using, the shared equity housing model is one that's very popular. Most of the not-for-profits in this room, my own included, are advocating shared equity models as one in a series of options. However, every mortgage banker with whom I speak about shared equity models hate them as an option. Now, my question then to the panel, are shared equity housing models and leveraging private sector capital incompatible?
I have a 20-year program where we've leveraged over $2 billion. We have effectively a shared equity model. The interest subsidy that goes in to help pay some of the interest for the buyer is repayable upon sale, but it depends on appreciation. We share appreciation, so if the property didn't appreciate, they don't have to pay us. We've got lots of banks participating in the program, including the big ones, and we secure that interest subsidy with a third mortgage on the property. So there's a lot of paper, but it works. We've done it.
Yeah, I think that shared equity, the phrase is used in two different contexts. And one is a shared equity home ownership model where the subsidy stays in the home, and the other is where the subsidy is in the mortgage through various means. Some of the permanent affordability models, community land trusts, limited equity co-ops, and such, they're different animals. And New Jersey CAPC and New Jersey Community Capital is involved with a countywide effort to start a community land trust as a form of permanent affordable housing. We don't know yet. We'll get back to you about what the banks are going to say. Although we do have a team of three or four banks on our planning committee that are looking into this for us, so that's always a good sign.
Sir?
The mic, please.
Oh, hi, Ray. I didn't
hi.
Recognize
you.
Right. Bright light.
The bright light.
Behind
yes,
you.
I try to work it that way. Otherwise, up on a high bench. Question for Massachusetts as far as the receivership, the nuisance abatement receivership. Who are the plaintiffs in the action, and has a governmental entity, city, ever been a plaintiff in the action? And then does the appointment of the receiver and the receiver's liens receive a status superior to other liens, such as a first mortgage lien? And three, can NSP money or are using NSP money for the receiverships?
Yes, yes, and no. So typically it is the municipalities bringing the action. You know, from my old tenant days, I would represent tenants who did that, but more recently with this initiative, it's been municipalities. Our state law does have a super lien, subject only to real estate taxes, so that's why our loan fund is making loans to the receivers. They're great loans because they prime everything else on the property. And the third question, NSP. We've been using NSP admin money as support for the infrastructure, but we haven't used program money. And it's really only recently with the expanded normal definition of abandoned that it even opens up the possibility. But the truth of it is with the super lien, we can use loan money. We don't need subsidy, really.
Are you just doing, are the receiverships all occupied properties,
no,
or are they vacant, some vacant and some occupied?
We actually had a case in Massachusetts that confirmed that it's okay to use receivership on a vacant property.
Mac?
A comment and a question. So on the shared equity thing, I think that we've been building a case about the relative good performance of lending in the shared equity space now, and well, we've done it through review of shared equity loans done through community land trusts and also through limited equity co-ops and stuff. And there's actually quite a good participation of lenders in that space. We've got the GSEs already have loan products in the books for community land trusts. There's NCB has lots of support for limited equity co-ops. And we've seen that the foreclosure rates in these shared equity lending is minuscule compared to the market itself. So it looks like, you know, to the extent that there's going to be any kind of appetite for additional debt out there, this is not going to be a tough sell to get more private capital in that space. The question and the comment I had is that it's really important to focus just for a moment on the pricing question, because this has been a vexing question that we've had to deal with right across the board from the beginning of NSP and before. I think it's an interesting exercise to think about the demand side pricing that Harold talked about for CAPC, where they actually looked at what they could afford to spend for a unit with the intent of actually making a program self-sustaining, versus the net realizable value that the National Community Stabilization Trust did, which is a supply-side mechanism for determining what price a servicer or other holder of the property might have, versus the requirements of NSP for getting the discount on the acquisition. And one of the things that we've seen, and maybe you want to comment on this, Harold, is that they're not always incompatible, but sometimes they are. And I don't know what you found in New Jersey, but we've seen that the prices that people can afford to pay are substantially lower if they want to make a sustainable and scalable program than what is expected on the supply side, and very often they all kind of run counter to what is permissible under NSP.
Right. I'm not sure about the NSP question, but we haven't had a huge amount of experience. The idea is to go to scale, so we've done these 47 mortgages and a few other deals. It takes a little bit of convincing, and we show everybody what we are doing, how we've come to our conclusions. Internally, the sellers have their own formulas. They have their own models, and they're going to compare that, which is what they did. They compare that with ours, and eventually they came to the conclusion that we made sense. So I don't know that we have a good systemized way of doing that to say, you know, this is a better or worse model. And that we just have a lot of evidence saying that there's face validity to what we were doing.
If I could add to that, one thing that would be good is if there was more ability to haggle through the NCST process. There really isn't very much of an ability to do that. The price comes out, you take it or leave it. And some of our analysis has shown that they have been able, the sellers are able to go on and sell the properties at the prices they wanted, to who we don't know whether the results are good or not. But with the kind of investment our buyers want to make, the purchase prices are not always the right ones. So more ability to really delve into that and to determine, is the price that's being asked us really going to result in a sustainable property? If the NCST, I know, you know, the NCST needs to have, you know, a quick process and certainty and all. But that kind of analysis added to the mix would be very helpful.
I think there's a real tension out there between market pricings and quality goals especially in terms of the nonprofit sector. That there are a lot of people out there, including a lot of investors, who are not only willing to essentially settle for putting housing back on the market, either as rental or ownership, at lower quality with less rehab, with less improvements and so forth than most nonprofits would like, but that given the depressed state of the market, if you try to add in the kind of quality improvements that, you know, you aspire to, you end up having a cost that is significantly higher than the market, and I think it's questionable in many markets whether you have that many buyers who want to pay that kind of a premium for what they may perceive as only a marginally better product than what's otherwise available. So I think we have there's a real tension. I mean, most nonprofits, I think, that are involved in the housing rehab business tend to have extremely high standards for what they want to put out as their product. And I think they're in this particular market environment, that may often result in those products, especially given what the prices are for the as-is stock coming through the REO process, being priced well above what the market is willing to pay for those houses, unless, of course, you put in huge amounts of subsidy, which in turn limits drastically the extent to which you can impact the market. So I think there's a real tension there, and I don't see quite how it's going to be resolved at this point.
Yeah, I just want to throw more and more of the organizations like the ones in Chicago and Minneapolis, Minnesota and L.A. are using for-profit developers as their exit. Their efficiencies are different, their cost structures are different, and they can still do a decent product. So to take a look at how we do it and they do it and see if we can find a decent middle ground.
And maybe, I was struck by Terry Gillen's comment yesterday about their experience in Philadelphia, which does have a strong nonprofit development infrastructure on national standards, and yet found that quite consistently they were getting faster, more cost-effective outcomes from the for-profit developers in their stable. And maybe, just conceivably, being a developer is not an optimal role for most nonprofit organizations. Just a thought. Sir, in the back.
Yeah, I'm George Rothman with MANA, a nonprofit here in D.C. No one has yet addressed the appraisal problem. Have none of you had issues with low appraisals?
Everybody has issues with low appraisals.
Well, how have you overcome them?
Judy?
Well, ask PJ next to you. I had one of those with him, and he folded for me, so gave it to us at the lower price. So, appraisals are estimates. So, you look at them, you look at them hard, you look at the assumptions, the comparables, and you just talk it through. But we've had problems.
Other questions? Last call, questions, comments? We have a couple of minutes, so if anybody would like to add any?
I got nervous at the end because I saw that you have to stop talking card. But I guess the one thing I would say is really just trying to think about this whole thing. The code, we've talked a lot about code enforcement, and receivership is a form of code enforcement. But, basic code enforcement, if we're not doing basic code enforcement in the neighborhoods we're investing NSP funds in, we're really missing the mark. And it's not a matter of training or, municipalities know how to do code enforcement. They just don't have enough people. And so providing some funding so they can put one of their guys on Saturday to do the targeted code enforcement you need in the neighborhood. That's what we're looking to do.
Yeah,
it's not rocket science.
I'd agree with you half. I'd certainly like to second. I think code enforcement, good, effective, targeted code enforcement, is incredibly important as a part of neighborhood stabilization. And that's a key thing that goes to what's happening with the other 90% of the properties in the neighborhood. I would disagree with you, though. It's funny. I don't think a lot of municipalities really know how to do code enforcement. I mean, I agree, certainly. They are financially strapped. When I talked about some ideas I had about targeted code enforcement in Phoenix, I was talking to the director of neighborhood services and said, look, I lost 30% of my positions last year. I'm about to lose another 25%. Don't bug me with new ideas, because we're barely able to do complaint response. But I think a lot of cities could use their code enforcement resources far more efficiently by using the kind of management systems, the kind of technology, increasing their skills and stuff And so I think it would be great to have some kind of program that would provide funding for municipalities to do code enforcement as part of neighborhood stabilization, but that would also work to make sure they were doing it in the most responsive and cost-effective fashion.
And modern
fashion, instead of the way it's often done in other places. We have two more questions. Okay.
Alan, thank you. Mary Tingerthal from the Housing Partnership Network. On the code enforcement issue, a really good model that I've seen is in the city of Chicago, where the director of code enforcement convenes a weekly SWAT team meeting of every department within the city that touches properties. So the police department, the health department, anyone that can touch a property, and they go through a critical list of vacant properties on a weekly basis and then feed that into their NSP program. So if people are looking for models, I think it's a really terrific one. The other comment I wanted to make is on Judy's comment about the long-term role of a coordinated community approach. Because with no matter what set of tools we have, there will always need to be a multiple of disciplines at the table to accomplish the sort of goals that Eric talked about this morning. And in I happen to be from Minnesota, and Judy mentioned the Minnesota Foreclosure Partners Council, which convened in 2007 and continues to meet on a monthly basis today. And what it does is it brings people with multiple disciplines to the table on a regular basis to compare notes on what's working, what's not working, are there places where either private or public resources need to be applied to make a piece of the puzzle work that's maybe been lagging or fallen off the table, or maybe there's an emerging problem that wasn't a problem 6 months ago. So I really think to create that impact on community, it's something that's a pretty low-cost thing to do if you don't count the in-kind time of all the people who attend the meetings. But in terms of keeping it going, it really doesn't take a lot. And it is a place where philanthropy or others can really play a role in making sure that that dialogue keeps fresh and keeps focused on what the emerging problems are. And it has been the McKnight Foundation in the Twin Cities that's made it possible to keep the Minnesota Council going. Thanks.
Ellen, if I could just make one response to Mary on the code enforcement. You know, the Chicago model is great. The city of Boston does that too. My colleague Evelyn Friedman, I suspect, will talk about her efforts doing that. These are high-capacity cities. This isn't Lawrence, Massachusetts. You know, last time I called my friend there, the CD director, he was on furlough. So there's a big difference between a high-capacity city who has the ability to marshal the resources to have that coordinated response. It's not the how do you do it. It's, again, it's getting the work done.
I think we went over here.
Thanks. This is a comment maybe for a bigger city, but just wanted to share with Baltimore. My name is Mike Mitchell. I'm the CEO of Habitat for Humanity of the Chesapeake in Baltimore, Maryland. We're working with the code enforcement right now, and we have had at least three or four long meetings with the code enforcement office and four or five other investors. And what we're doing with them is we're targeting, we've basically agreed with these other investors that as the code enforcement office pries up properties, we will purchase those properties in a very targeted area. And so working with these other investors, developers, we're able to really focus on this really tough area. And it's, I think it's a model. The head of code enforcement in Baltimore is a really genius person. So there's something working in some other jurisdictions, but I realize it's Baltimore is not Lawrence, Massachusetts. So.
Thank you.
Rob Grossinger from Enterprise. Mac brought up pricing, and Harold, I just want to, I think this is something that we, whoever we are, need a lot more knowledge about. For example, in your situation, you bought portfolio loans, which pricing is much different from for portfolio versus securitized. Mm-hmm. You bought a whole pool, and pricing is much different if you're buying a whole pool versus buying pieces of a pool. And so, you know, Mac was talking about, well, is pricing done? Can pricing be done by the buyer based on what the ultimate outcome can be versus by the seller? Each component of what you did has a different impact on pricing, whether, again, whether you're buying securitized versus portfolio, whether you're buying a whole pool versus part of a pool. One of the things I don't think we know enough about, and if anyone in here does, I'd love to talk to them at lunch, or I don't think we have lunch, sometime, is these large funds, what's their economic and business model? And if it's replicated by those of us that care about neighborhood stabilization, do we then have to practice things we don't really want to do? Is there jettisoning of the bad assets that would have to be done if you start partnering with them that you don't really want to do in our world? Alan brought up rehab standards, which are hugely different between what for-profit versus nonprofit may do. So learning more about how these large acquisitions are happening, what happens to all of the assets within those large acquisitions, what's the economic model that makes it work, I think is really important for us as these partnerships that we keep talking about that we need to do unfold.
I don't know if there's been any formal research on this, but certainly from my experience as a former housing and economic development director in the city and that of lots of other people, I think it is generally recognized that the business model for bulk purchase, and this was certainly true back in the 90s and with the bulk purchase of tax liens and tax foreclosed properties and more, that the business model is, in many it's a triage model, and that vast numbers of urban properties were essentially jettisoned and abandoned by investors during the wave of tax lien bulk sales. And there's certainly at least some evidence. I know the Pittsburgh neighborhood, I think in Atlanta, is one where people have looked at this, where this has been a byproduct of bulk purchase of distressed properties today. I think it's something that would be well worth doing some research to quantify and explore the implications of, but I think it's certainly widely recognized as a phenomenon out there. I think we have one last question here, and then I think it'll be time for us to move on. Ma'am.
Hi, Gladys Margarita Diaz from Miami, Florida. I'm an NSP vendor, and I'm a private sector person. I'm a small business. I'm an architect, and I'm also in a real estate brokerage division in my company. As an architect, I deal with code enforcement a great deal. And I think one of the issues that I hope comes out of this meeting is developing some ideas on how to engage the community in code enforcement. I think one of the things I see is when people see a code enforcement officer, they're like, oh, my God, I got to hide. Something bad is coming down the road, as opposed to somebody that's helping you to maintain the value of your property. In certain cities, I'm going to tell you a challenge. I was hired by a municipality in Dade County, and we had 75 properties in the municipality. It's a small city, and they could not. They were owned by a variety of lenders, these properties that were abandoned, and we were charged with the task of finding who to talk to see who could take responsibility for these properties. I can tell you that I spent hundreds of man hours trying to track down who the loan officer was, and they eventually hung up on me when I said, we really would like you to take some responsibility and board up this building or do whatever it has to do with cleanup. So I think one of the things that I heard yesterday was the streamlining process that Fannie Mae and everyone else is working on with the lenders is going to enable those of us in the front lines to work with people who are going to take responsibility for these properties. So I see that's a light at the end of the tunnel. So I think that if you guys come up with a summary of this activity, that would be one of the key components.
Thank you. I should mention, by the way, that recent New Jersey law requires when a lender initiates the foreclosure, they must give notice to the municipality including contact information for an entity that will accept service on their behalf and contact information for whomever is responsible for maintaining the property. And if the property becomes vacant, they are deemed to have the legal responsibility to comply with any codes that the owner would have to comply with. So that hopefully will help. Well, thank you all, and thank you to the panel.
Okay, yes. Thank you, definitely, Alan, for leading that and for helping us make up a little time. We are actually breaking until 11:15, and Tammy Edwards will be leading panel 5. So we'll see you back at 11:15.
Thanks, Alan.
I couldn't even. It gave the judge an aura, though.